This is a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Education as a Force for Social Change. Lecture 4, given in Dornach, August 15th, 1919. From what I said previously, you will certainly have recognized that the question of education is the most important question occupying people today. I needed to emphasize that education is central to our social problems. After my lecture a week ago concerning reforming and transforming the school system, you will certainly understand that the most important question in education is that of teacher training. If you consider the character of the period that clearly began in the middle of the 15th century, you will certainly have an impression of human development undergoing waves of materialistic ordeals. Now, our greatest need is to work ourselves out of that materialism and find a path back to a more spiritual attitude. In all previous periods of human culture, people knew the path toward spirituality, but they knew it more or less instinctively and unconsciously. Humanity lost that knowledge so that we could seek it again in a completely conscious manner, motivated by our desire to find our own freedom. The transition humanity has undergone since the middle of the 15th century could be called the materialistic ordeal of humanity. If you consider the character of that materialistic time, and then consider with some insight the cultural development of the last 3 or 4 centuries into our own time, you will find that the materialistic wave that broke in upon humanity has affected the education of teachers most intensely. Nothing could make as lasting an impression as the way materialism has permeated pedagogy. We need only look rationally at some specific examples of modern teaching methods to see the great difficulties lying in the way of achieving truly fruitful progress. We need but recall how those who believe themselves particularly capable of speaking about education continually repeat that all education, beginning at the lowest level, must be illustrative, or at least what people call illustrative. I have often mentioned that people want, for instance, to make arithmetic illustrative by using mechanical devices. People place such great value upon allowing children first to see everything, and then from this visualization to create a picture or idea in their own souls. The desire for visualization is certainly justifiable in many areas of education, but it forces us to question what will happen to children after they have been educated through this visual teaching method. If we teach children only according to that visual hands-on method, they will become completely withered in their souls. The power within their souls will slowly die, and human nature will become connected with that visualized environment. The tender shoot which should grow within the soul will slowly die. Much of the modern illustrative teaching method results in the death of the soul. Of course, people do not know they are killing the soul. Nevertheless, it dies. We can already experience the result in people today. Just look at how many modern adults have what we might call troubled natures. Look at how many cannot find anything within themselves that could give them consolation and hope in difficult times, and enable them to cope with the complexities of life. Today we see many broken people, and we even see, at least at times, that we ourselves cannot find our way in life. This all relates to the deficiencies in our education, in particular to the deficiencies in the training of teachers. What do we need to do to improve teacher training? That teachers know the answers to questions put to them in their examinations is relatively unimportant, since they are mostly answers the teacher could look up, as needed, in nearly any reference book. However, what the examinations completely ignore is the general condition of the teacher's soul, something that continuously transfers to the pupils. There is an enormous difference between what happens when one teacher enters the classroom and what happens when another enters. When one teacher steps into the classroom, the children feel a kind of inner soul relationship with the teacher. When another teacher enters, the children often feel no such relationship. To the contrary, they often feel a gulf between themselves and their teacher, and experience all possible shades of indifference, to the point of laughing at or deriding the teacher. All the nuances lying between those two extremes often exist, to the detriment of genuine teaching and education. The burning question is, therefore, how can we change teacher training in the future? No change is possible unless the teacher accepts the knowledge of human nature that comes from spiritual science. The relationship of human beings to the supersensible worlds must completely permeate the teacher. He or she must be able to see in the growing child proof that the child has entered earthly life from the supersensible world through birth, has clothed itself with a physical body. The teacher must be able to see that the child has taken on tasks that the teacher is to assist with here in the physical world, because the child could not take on those tasks during the period before rebirth. The teacher must feel that he or she should perceive each child as a question posed by the supersensible world to the sense-perceptible world. You cannot ask that question in a concrete and comprehensive manner, that is, in relation to each individual child, unless you can use the knowledge of spiritual science about the nature of the human being. In the course of the last 3 or 4 centuries, people have become more and more accustomed to looking only at human physiology and at the human physical constitution. That is the most detrimental viewpoint for the teacher. For that reason, it is of utmost necessity that in the future pedagogy take root in the anthropology arising out of anthroposophy. That is, however, not possible unless we understand the human being as a being consisting of 3 aspects, as we have often mentioned here from many perspectives. However, you must commit yourself to a true inner comprehension of these 3 aspects. I have repeatedly pointed out the various ways human beings, as they stand before us now, can be seen as nerve-sense beings. We commonly express this by saying that someone is, quote-unquote, all head. We find, at least superficially, the 2nd aspect of human nature, namely the chest being, in those people in whom rhythmic processes predominate. Then, as you know, we have that aspect of the human being connected with the metabolism, namely the limb or metabolic human being in which the metabolism as such occurs. The complete external picture, the complete physical form of the active human being, is of a being composed of these 3 aspects. To summarize, the 3 aspects of human nature are the head or nerve being, the chest or rhythmic being, and the limb, or in its broadest sense, of course, the metabolic being. The question is, how should we understand the differences between these 3 aspects of human nature? That is something that makes modern people uncomfortable, since they like to divide things mechanically. If you say to someone that the human being consists of a head, a chest, and a limb being, they want to draw a line at the neck and call what lies above the head being. They then want to draw another line somewhere else to delineate the chest being, and thus have the different aspects placed one after the other. Modern people do not easily accept things they cannot mechanically describe. However, in reality, things are not so simple, since there are no such lines. It is true that the human being above the shoulders is primarily a head or sense nerve being. However, it is so not only above the shoulders. For example, the senses of touch or temperature spread out over the entire body. In the same way, the head aspect extends out over the entire body. If you want to speak that way, you could say that the human head is primarily head and that the chest is less so. Nevertheless, the chest also presents aspects of the head. The limbs or everything that has to do with the metabolism are even less so. Nevertheless, the head aspect also appears in them. Thus, we would have to say that the entire human being is head, but the head is primarily head. If we wanted to draw that schematically, then we would need to draw the head aspect of the human being in this manner, shown as white in the sketch. The chest aspect of the human being is again not only in the chest, although it is primarily in the organs contained within the chest, in those organs that most clearly express the heart and breathing rhythms. However, breathing continues into the head, and the blood circulation continues its rhythm into the head and limbs. We can therefore say that the human being is, of course, chest in this region, shown as red in the sketch, but also here in the head, although less, and here in the limbs still less. Thus the entire human being is chest, but this, pointing to the chest in the sketch, is primarily the chest, and that the head. Again, the limb or metabolic aspect of the human being is primarily here, shown as blue in the sketch, but the limbs continue and are somewhat less in the chest region and least in the head. Just as we can say that the head is head, we can state just as truthfully that the entire human being is head. Just as we can say that the chest is chest, we can state just as truthfully that the entire human being is chest, and so forth. In reality, these things intermingle. However, our understanding tends to want to put things next to one another and to separate the various aspects. That shows us how little our cognitive ideas relate to external reality. In external reality, things flow into one another, and we must be aware that when we separate the head, chest, and metabolic aspects of the human being, we also have to think of these separated aspects as a whole. We may never think of things only in their constituent parts, but must also think of them united. Let me say that again. We may never think of things only in their constituent parts, but must also think of them united. A person who would want to think of things only in their parts is the same as someone who would want only to inhale and never to exhale. There you have something similar to what must occur for the future in the thinking of teachers. Teachers must be particularly adept at this kind of inwardly mobile thinking, this non-mechanical kind of thinking. Only when they accustom themselves to this kind of fluid thinking can they approach reality with their souls. However, people cannot approach reality if they cannot grasp things from a larger perspective than is currently fashionable. When viewing things scientifically, people will need to overcome the prevailing modern habit of looking only at the details and learn to connect the details with the larger questions of life. The question of immortality will become an important question for all further development of spiritual culture in the future. We will need to become clear about how a large portion of humanity understands immortality, particularly now when many people have gone so far as to deny immortality. What is it that lives in many people today who attempt to understand immortality from the basis of the more common religions? What lives in those people is a need to know something about what happens to the soul when a human being passes through the gate of death. If we ask why people are interested in the question of immortality, or perhaps better said, the question of the eternal life at the core of human nature, we receive no answer other than that they mainly want to know what happens when people pass through the gate of death. People know that they have an I, capital, and that in this I lives their thinking, feeling, and willing. The thought that this I might be destroyed is for them unbearable. What people want to know is that we can carry the I through death, and what happens to the I after death. The interest people have in that question arises from the fact that religions, at least the ones under consideration here, mainly speak of immortality or eternal human life in answer to the question of what happens to the human soul when a person passes through the gate of death. Now, you certainly must feel that the question of immortality, when posed that way, leaves an extremely strong egotistical aftertaste. It is a fundamentally selfish desire that arises within people when they want to know what happens to the essence of their being as they pass through the gate of death. If modern people had greater self-awareness, they would consider the question more carefully and not give in to such illusions. People would see how strongly egotism acts in their interest to learn about the fate of the soul after death. That kind of attitude within the soul became particularly strong during the period of materialistic trials that occurred in the last 3 or 4 centuries. We cannot overcome what has grasped the human soul in its habits of feeling and thinking through, for instance, theories or hypotheses, so long as these theories and hypotheses are abstract. Nevertheless, we most certainly must ask, can things remain like this? That is, can the selfish aspect of human nature have the only say about the question of the eternal existence of the essence of a human being? If you look at everything connected with that complex of questions, then you must admit that the reason the human soul has the attitude I just described is essentially that religions have failed to take up another perspective. They have failed to look at how the soul increasingly permeates the physical body when a human being is born, how it grows into the world at the baby's first cry. They have failed to look at what lives within human beings in the spiritual world before birth. How often today do we hear the question about what continues from the spiritual realms when a human being is born and enters physical existence? What we hear time and again is the question of what is carried forward when the human being dies. We rarely hear the question of what is carried forward when a human being is born. In the future, we will need to give more attention to that question. In a certain sense, we must learn to hear the revelation of the spirit soul of growing children and how it was before birth. We must learn to see in growing children the continuation of their stay in the spiritual world. Then our relationship to eternal human nature will become less and less egotistical. If you have no interest in what continues from the spiritual world in physical life, but are only interested in what continues after death, then you are inwardly egotistical. In a certain sense, the foundation of a selfless attitude within the soul exists in looking at how we carry the spiritual world into physical existence. Due to their egotism, people do not ask about that continuation, because they are certain they exist and are content with that idea. People are only uncertain that they will exist after death and therefore want it and want to have it proven. It is their selfishness that leads to that. However, true understanding will not occur through human egotism, not even from that subtle egotism we have just characterized as creating interest in the continued existence of the soul after death. Can we deny that religions reckon with that form of egotism? We must overcome that kind of selfish speculation. Those who can look into the spiritual world know that overcoming that speculation will bring not just greater understanding, it will bring an entirely different attitude of people toward their surroundings. People will feel and perceive children much differently when they see in them a continuation of something that could no longer remain in the spiritual world. Think for a moment how the question changes when viewed from that standpoint. We could then say that a human being existed in the spiritual world before he or she moved through birth into the physical world. There it must have been that the individual could no longer reach his or her goal. The spiritual world could no longer provide what the individual's soul needed. As the time of birth approached, a need thus arose to move from the spiritual world into the physical and to take on a physical body to seek in the physical world what the individual could no longer find in the spiritual. You will acquire a tremendous depth of understanding of life if you know how to use this standpoint, to use it with feeling and perception. Whereas the egotistical standpoint causes people to become increasingly abstract, to pursue the theoretical and tend toward head-bound thinking, what arises from the other perspective, the selfless perspective, causes people to recognize and comprehend the world through increasing love. That is one of the elements we must bring into the education of teachers, namely to look at prenatal human existence and not consider only the riddle of death. Teachers also need to have a feeling for life in connection with the riddle of birth. We must also learn to raise anthropology to the level of anthroposophy, by acquiring a feeling for the forms that express the three aspects of the human being. Recently I posed the question whether the human head, that is, that part of the human being that is primarily head and is spherical, is merely set upon the remainder of the organism. If we then look at the human chest aspect, how does it appear to us? The human chest is such that we could take a portion of the head, and if we were to enlarge it, then we would have the backbone. The head has its center within itself, but the center of the human chest lies very far away. If you think of that quote-unquote head, to which the chest belongs, as extremely large, you will see that this large head resembles that of a person lying on his or her back. If we think of the spinal column as an incomplete head, we would have a horizontally lying person and a vertically standing person. When we look at the metabolic aspect of the human being, it becomes so complicated that we can no longer draw it on a plane. In short, concerning their forms, the three aspects of human nature present themselves quite differently. The head is complete, whereas the chest aspect is incomplete and only a fragment, and then we have the metabolic aspect. Now, why is the human head complete? It is complete because of all the human aspects, the human head is the best adjusted to the physical world. Regardless of how unusual that may sound to you, since you customarily consider the human head the most noble aspect of the human being, it is nevertheless correct that it is best adapted to physical existence. It best expresses physical existence. Thus, if we want to find the primary characteristics of the human body, we must first look toward the head, since the human head is the most physical part of the body. The human chest and rhythmic organs are most closely connected with the etheric body, and the metabolic organs most connected with the astral body. The capital I has no clear expression in the physical world at all. We have now come to something that is particularly important to look at closely, and that you should thoroughly understand. You should understand that when you look at the human head, that is, what I drew in white, you have before you the most important aspect of the physical human body. The head most completely expresses the visible human being. The etheric body is more active in the human chest aspect. The etheric body is least active in the head and most active in the chest. Therefore, from a physical perspective, the human chest aspect is less complete than the head, physically less complete. The metabolic aspect of the human being is certainly very incomplete, because there the etheric body is active only very little, and the astral body is most active. As I have often emphasized, the I is still a baby and has barely any physical correspondence. Thus you see that we can describe a human being by saying that human beings have a physical body. If you question what portion of the human being is most like the physical body, the answer is the spherical head. The human being also exists in the etheric body. What most closely resembles the etheric body? The chest fragment. The human being also has an astral body, and what most closely resembles the astral body? The metabolic human aspect. It is hardly possible to point to something corresponding to the I, capital, in the physical human being. Thus each of the three aspects of the human being, namely the head or sense-nerve being, the chest or rhythmical being, and the metabolic being, becomes a picture for something standing behind it. The head is a picture of the physical body, the chest of the etheric body, and the metabolic system of the astral body. That is what people must learn. Not to consider people in the manner done so often today, whereby a corpse is examined and some piece of flesh is considered in one way or another, independent of whether it exists in the chest or in the head. People will need to learn that the head, chest, and metabolic aspects of human beings relate differently to the cosmos and provide a pictorial expression of the different things that they represent. In that way, we will extend today's simply anthropological manner of observation into anthroposophy. the chest and head organs are equivalent when considered purely physically. Whether you examine the lung or the brain is unimportant from a material perspective. However, from a spiritual perspective, that is not at all the case. From a spiritual perspective, if you dissect the brain, you really have fairly clearly before you what you dissect. If you dissect the chest, for example, the lungs, what you have before you is much less clear, since the etheric body plays such a tremendously important role there during the time people sleep. What I have just discussed has a spiritual counterpart. Those who have made progress through the meditations and exercises you can find described in our literature slowly come to understand that the human being truly exists in three aspects. As you know, I have spoken of these three aspects from a certain standpoint in the chapter of my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, where I speak of the guardians of the threshold. However, you can also achieve a picture of the three aspects through strong concentration upon yourself. You can actually separate the head, chest, and metabolic aspects. You will then see why your head is the head you have. If through inner concentration you separate your head with all its component parts from the remainder of the organism so that it is uninfluenced by the other aspects of human nature, it is dead and lives no more. It is impossible to separate clairvoyantly the head from the remainder of the human organism without perceiving it as a corpse. You can do that with the chest aspect, and it remains alive. If you separate the astral body by separating the metabolic aspect of the human being, then it will run from you. It remains in place no longer, but follows cosmic movements because the astral body has that tendency. Now imagine standing before a human child and observing him or her objectively and soberly, as I just discussed. You look at the head, and it contains death within it. You look at what affects the head from the chest and see that it enlivens everything. You look at the child beginning to run, and you recognize that it is actually the astral body that is active in that running. Now the human essence becomes somewhat more transparent for you inwardly. The head, a corpse. The outspreading life in the human being, quiet when the person is still. At the moment the child begins to run, you immediately notice that it is actually the astral body that runs. The child can run because the astral body is running, and in moving it consumes material. Thus the metabolism is active in a certain sense. But the I, how can we observe that? We have truly run out of possibilities. After we have considered the head corpse, the life-spending chest aspect, and running, what remains so that we could externally look at the eye? As I said, the eye hardly has a physical counterpart. You can only see the eye when you look at human beings in their continuing growth. At the age of one, they are quite small, at two, larger, and so forth. When you see them growing larger and larger and add to it everything that occurs during the ensuing stages, you see the eye physically. You never see the human eye when you just look at a person. You can see it only when you see the person growing. If people would not give in to illusions, but instead would see reality, then it would be clear that they could not easily perceive the eye physically. You can see the eye only when you look at a person at different ages in life. If you see someone after 20 years, then you perceive that person's eye quite strongly in the changes that occurred, particularly if you saw that person 20 years before as a child. You should not consider what I have just said simply theoretically, but use it to enliven your thinking. When you look at a person's head as corpse, chest as enlivening, movement as the astral body, growth as the eye, consider how that enlivens the entire person who previously stood before you like a porcelain doll. What of the human being do people usually see with their physical eyes and comprehend with their intellect? Simply a porcelain doll. That comes alive when you add to it what I have just discussed. Of course, you need to permeate your view with what spiritual science can provide for your feelings and perceptions concerning the relationship of the human being to the world. A running child reveals its astral body to you, for what lies in the gesture of running, and every child runs differently, comes from the individual's astral body. What lies in growth is imprinted by the I. Here you can see how karma strongly affects the human being. Let us take an example no longer closely connected with the present, namely Johann Gottlieb Fichte. I have described him from various perspectives. At other times I have described him as a great philosopher, as a Bolshevist, and so forth. However, let us look at him from still another standpoint. You will recall how I showed that we could certainly consider Fichte a Bolshevist, but we now want to look at him in a different way. Suppose we were to stand out in the street and Fichte went by. We would look at him and think to ourselves that he is not a very large man, rather stocky. What does the way he grew reveal to us? Suppressed growth. When we look at the way he walks, we see how he stamps along on his heels. There we see the entire Fichte eye. You would not miss the slightest detail of what the man was as you watch him stamp along on his heels and see his suppressed growth, his stocky, compact body caused by malnutrition in his youth. You could hear how he spoke by observing him from behind. A spiritual element can come into the externalities of life. However, that is not possible if people do not have a different attitude than currently exists in their souls. Looking at their neighbors that way would be a very unkind indiscretion for modern people. Modern people do not like to be looked at that way, because they are mainly formed by materialism and its way of spreading. They do not open letters not addressed to them, only because it is prohibited. Otherwise they would open them. People with that attitude find it unacceptable that everything might be different. Nevertheless, since the middle of the 15th century, the earth has achieved what people cannot reach in earthly existence, unless they comprehend the human being spiritually, right into the physical. As we move into the future, we will need to learn how to spiritually comprehend everything sense perceptible. That must begin with the pedagogical activity of the teachers in relationship to the growing child. Physiognomically oriented pedagogy requires that teachers have the will to solve the greatest human riddle of each individual through education. Perhaps now you can feel how strong are what I call the trials of humanity in our times. What I discussed increasingly compels us to consider each person an individual human being that must hover above us as a great ideal. Namely, no one is like anyone else, and everyone is an individual being. Were the earth to achieve its goal without us recognizing the individuality of each human being, then humanity would not reach its goal upon earth. However, today we are certainly far from the attitude that strives toward that goal. Today we make everyone the same and see people such that we do not consider their individual characteristics. I have often spoken of Hermann Bahr. Once in Berlin, he told how people no longer see others as individuals. During the 1890s, he lived in Berlin for a time and was active in Berlin society. He, of course, had a woman seated to the left and one to the right at dinner every evening. However, as he sat between two different women on succeeding evenings, he noticed that he could tell they were different women only because of the place cards. He did not look at them very closely because the woman from yesterday and the one from today were essentially the same. What he saw was just the same. Our industrial society makes people externally all the same and does not allow an expression of individuality. In this way, modern people move toward stereotypes, whereas the innermost human goal must be to strive toward recognition of the individual. At present, we attempt to camouflage individuality, but it is essential that we seek it. Directing the inner view of the soul toward a recognition of the individual must begin with education. The education of teachers must assume the attitude of seeking the individuality in each person. That is only possible if we enliven our idea of the human being as I have presented it today. We must become truly conscious that it is not simply a mechanism that moves us, it is the astral body which carries the physical body along with it. Compare what arises in your soul, inwardly enlivened, a moving picture of the entire human being, with what conventional science now provides, pure illusion. Science says nothing about the human being, but simply preaches illusions. We must bring the true human being into pedagogy, and now it is totally left out. The problem of education is actually a problem of training teachers. As long as we do not see that, we are not so far along that something fruitful can occur in education. Seen from a higher perspective, everything is connected. Today, people prefer to develop human capacities, the inner capacities of human beings, as separate subjects. People learn anthropology and then religion, but they do not learn the relationship of one to the other. In reality, as you have seen, the consideration of the human being is related to the question of immortality and eternal human nature. We must bring that question into direct connection with our view of human beings. In particular, we must bring the flexibility of experience within the soul. We will then develop inner capacities quite different from those developed today in the teachers' colleges. That is of particular importance. In my considerations today, I wanted to show you that spiritual science must permeate everything. We cannot solve the great social problems of the present without spiritual science. The end of Lecture 4.